From our ancient and glorious festival of Passover, we and the world may learn some very important truths to guide us in our life today. Passover celebrates the first revolution in human history, the first revolution for human rights and for man's freedom from slavery. This occurred a long time ago. Some 3,200 years ago in ancient Egypt. But the intervening centuries have not dimmed at all the radiance of that heroic event. And the heart of man today is still stirred, moved by that desperate and imperious cry which has rung down the ages, "Let my people go." For hundreds of years, our forefathers, a people previously free, which had migrated into Egypt, and had lived there in peace in the delta of the Nile for a long time, had become, because of a change in Egyptian rulers and their imperial policies, subjugated to severe repressive measures. They came to be treated as an alien and hostile people, finally were reduced to total, hopeless, and degrading slavery. At that time, at the time when our forefathers were enslaved in Egypt, Egypt was not a backward or uncivilized country, any more than Germany was under the Nazis, or South Africa today is under the Afrikaners. For over 150 years under the 18th dynasty, beginning with Thutmose III, who has been called the greatest of all the pharaohs, Egypt had been enjoying a brilliant era of imperial expansion, of great wealth, and it had been constructing great cities and palaces on a heroic scale. Its African empire extended from the Fourth Cataract on the Upper Nile to the shores of the Mediterranean, and its Asiatic empire embraced the whole of Canaan and Phoenicia and extended as far as the Euphrates in Mesopotamia. It was an age of great prosperity and wealth, power. But this prosperity was not shared by the Egyptian masses. It was the king and the ruling classes and the military and the priestly hierarchy. It is for them that the great palaces and pleasure gardens were built, and in preparations for their death, the great tombs and the pyramids were constructed. The peasants, the laboring classes, were dreadfully exploited. And through the long dreary centuries, they remained, these masses, silent, dumb, submissive. For they had been taught from infancy that they belong, body and soul, to the pharaohs, who were the gods incarnate, whose rule was absolute, whose actions could not be questioned, and to whom everything in Egypt and everyone belonged. The Hebrews were now forced into even deeper degradation than these proletarian masses of Egypt. They were made total slaves. They were marshaled into labor battalions, into labor gangs, and forced, under the whip of the taskmasters, to build the cities and the palaces and the storehouses which the pharaohs, who were great builders, wanted and ordered. And the Egyptians, we read in our Bible, made their lives, the lives of these Hebrews, bitter, bitter, with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. And in all their work, they made them serve with rigor. When they complained, these enslaved Hebrews, or when their work seemed slack in the eyes of the overseers, they were brutally beaten and whipped by their taskmasters, just as the Africans, the natives of Africa, the native workers were recently beaten and whipped for refusing to go to work and driven back to their work by the South African police. But the Hebrews' masters, the Egyptians, were for some reason afraid of them, afraid of the very people whom they enslaved. These Hebrews seemed to be somehow different from their own dumb, submissive masses. They seemed to treasure some kind of a tradition of freedom, a remembrance that once they were free, they were the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the fires were still smoldering in their souls after the long centuries of slavery. They were dampened, but they were not extinguished. And, says the Bible, the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. Vayakutsu mipnei bnei Israel. And because they were afraid, they resorted to desperate measures to reassure themselves, to guard themselves. What were they afraid of? They were afraid of their numbers, says the Bible. Just as the Afrikaners, who are outnumbered 4-1 by the African natives, are afraid today, and being afraid, are resorting to desperate measures. Now the Israelites actually did not outnumber the Egyptians. But the Egyptians were afraid, says the Bible, lest they multiply. And if war befall us, they will join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. They hated the Hebrews, they feared them, but they did not want them to escape from the land. They needed them for their hard labor and for their dirty work, which they themselves were unwilling to do. They were not willing to sacrifice this readily available cheap labor of the Hebrew slaves. The Afrikaners, too, would like the 10 million native Africans to be separated from them. That is the meaning of apartheid, their policy which they adopted, complete and total separation. But neither do they want these 10 million to escape from the land. The prosperity of the white man in South Africa depends chiefly upon mining and agriculture, and 87% of the labor in the mines is Negro, and 92% of the labor on the farms of these white men is Negro. And this inner contradiction, wanting to get rid of them, not wanting them to leave, this inner contradiction forced the ancient Egyptians, who dwelt in the northern part, the northern tip of Africa, as it does today their modern descendants, the Afrikaners who dwell in the southern tip of Africa, this inner contradiction forced them to take counsel. Hava nishakmalo. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, since we cannot deal justly. The Israelites are too many for us, or there's the danger lest they become too many for us. We will have every male child born to the Hebrews cast into the Nile River. Now, this always appeared to me to be so incredible, this matter of casting newborn children into the Nile River, an edict of a great and powerful empire. It always appeared to me so incredible, so fantastically nightmarish, that I was inclined to write it off as a sort of a blown up legend of long ago. It really never happened. It couldn't happen. Until the Nazis showed me how wrong I was. They too took counsel together how to deal shrewdly with the Jewish problem. And they issued a decree, an edict, not to cast Jewish children into the Nile River, but to cast them into the gas chambers. I read recently a book, the autobiography of Rudolf Hess. Rudolf Hess was the commandant of Auschwitz from 1941 to 1943. That's in our own lifetime. That's in the lifetime of everybody who is listening to me this morning. Not 3,200 years ago in ancient Egypt. Rudolf Hess, the commandant of Auschwitz, writes in this autobiography of his, "I personally arranged, on orders received from Himmler in May 1941, the gassing of 2 million persons between June, July 1941 and the end of 1943, during which time I was commandant of Auschwitz." And in his autobiography, this gentleman writes, I remember, too, a woman who tried to throw her children out of the gas chamber just as the door was closing. And weeping, she called out, "At least, let my precious children live." There were many such shattering scenes, says this gentleman, which affected all who witnessed them. On one occasion, two small children were so absorbed in some game that they quite refused to let their mother tear them away from it. Even the Jews of the special detachment were reluctant to pick the children up. The imploring look in the eyes of the mother, who certainly knew what was happening, is something I shall never forget, writes this gentleman. The people were already in the gas chamber and becoming restive, and I had to act. Everyone was looking at me. I nodded to the junior non-commissioned officer on duty, and he picked up the screaming, struggling children in his arms and carried them into the gas chamber, accompanied by their mother, who was weeping in the most heartrending fashion. "Oh, my pity was so great," writes this gentleman, "that I longed to vanish from the scene, yet I might not show the slightest trace of emotion." So he stayed on, supervised the gassing of 2 million human beings, including children. And so I am no longer startled. I no longer think the story at all incredible. Well, the Afrikaners, as part of their solution of their problem, how to deal shrewdly with people whom they did not want and yet needed, have adopted a policy which so far has resulted in the uprooting of many of the native Africans, driving them back to their Bantu reservations, but by no means all of them. All the workers that they needed, the workers that are needed for their mines and their shops and their factories and their farms and in their homes to be the hewers of wood and the drawers of water, they retained them, of course. They didn't send them back. But they retained them under the most cruel and severe and humiliating controls. Of course, they segregated them and excluded them rigidly from all public places. They see to it that not a one of them shall ever become a skilled worker, nor attend any school where he can learn mechanical skill. A native may wash your car in the garage, but he cannot fix your motor, the motor of that car. Of course, he has no vote. And even the colored Africans, those of mixed blood, of whom there are about 1.5 million in South Africa, principally around Cape Town, the areas of the Cape of Good Hope, even they have now been deprived of their vote, and they can be represented in Parliament by 4 white people, not by any colored people. And every native African must carry with him a passbook giving his identity and the record of his jobs, a passbook which sharply limits the freedom of his movement. It is this passbook, which is not required of the white man, the well-known stigma of the yellow badge, it is this passbook which was responsible for the recent riots around Johannesburg and Cape Town, which resulted in the killing of some 75 natives and the wounding of some hundreds of them. because the natives had finally decided to burn these passbooks. Not to carry them, to go to jail if necessary, to demonstrate against them. And when they were shot down, mourning was decreed by them among their own people, a strike of protest, which was 90% successful. And then the government took fright. Why, if these people continue with their strike, we are through. Our industry breaks down. There'll be no gold and no diamonds coming out of our mines in Johannesburg and Kimberley. And they declared a state of emergency. And they outlawed the African National Congress and arrested hundreds of Negro leaders in true Nazi fashion in the dead of night, rousing them out of their beds and holding them, detaining them without warrant. That is the situation in South Africa today. Tension, terror. The Prime Minister of South Africa, principal spokesman of this apartheid policy, was shot, not by a colored man, but by a white man. It's usually white men who fight each other over the issue of the colored man. That's what we did in the Civil War. No one would advocate such actions of attempted assassination as a solution for this grave problem. This is no solution, but I recall from my reading of the Bible that even Moses seeing a Hebrew slave beaten almost unto death by an Egyptian taskmaster, Moses, the man of God, killed the Egyptian. We can understand these actions even though we do not approve of them. The Afrikaners are determined to push through at all costs their apartheid policies, even if it means terror and dictatorship and the swinging club and the rifle butt. They are resentful of criticism, what they call interference from without. The world has protested. These Afrikaners turn a deaf ear unto all these protests because they actually feel themselves very righteous. They actually feel themselves very religious. Their leaders often quote the Bible. Of course, very selectively. But they quote it. They will not quote such passages as, "Thou shalt not oppress thy neighbor nor rob him. Thou shalt not grind the face of the poor." They won't quote that. They won't quote from the book of Enoch, "Woe to you who build your palaces with the grievous toil of others, each stone, each brick of which it is built is a sin." They have, so they maintain, a noble program and a noble mission. Their mission, of course, is to bring civilization to darkest Africa. And it is God himself who bestowed this mission upon them and their Dutch ancestors who came to South Africa some 300 years ago. They therefore feel that they are ruling by God's will And anybody who feels that he's ruling by God's will is a danger to civilization and to mankind. Divine rights of kings is a threat to the freedom of man. That's their mission, to civilize. And their program is to separate the two races, the white from the black, and permit each, they say, to develop separately on the basis of its own culture and its own traditions in their own territory, where they will have, the natives, limited privileges of self-government under the overall rule, of course, of the whites. But do they intend to separate the races territorially, geographically? Not at all. Do they intend to distribute the wealth which the native helped to accumulate fairly between themselves and the native? Not at all. They will push out those whom they do not need, retain the others. The black would remain the labor force in the white areas. And this, the Afrikaners maintain, will be a real boon to the natives, even if the natives don't see it that way. These racialists, whether in South Africa or in Germany or elsewhere, these racialists are all do-gooders. They're always performing mitzvahs. All that they do for the benefit of the man who's being done. I recall a Jewish preacher, a Maggid, who some time ago told the story of a notorious wealthy miser to whom a poor man came asking for food. And the miser finally gave him food. Miserable, spoiled food, which the poor man devoured. But the poor man soon became violently sick of the food of which he ate and died 2 days later. Whereupon this wealthy miser went about in his community bragging that he had performed four mitzvahs. He had performed four mitzvahs. In the first place, he had entertained a stranger. In the second place, he had fed the hungry. In the third place, he had visited the sick. And in the fourth place, he had buried the dead. Now, our forefathers, the ancient Hebrews, did not remain in Egypt. Finally, they had enough of it. Finally stirred and aroused by a great leader, the world's first and greatest revolutionist and emancipator, Moses, they arose one night and by a prearranged signal. They left Egypt. The Egyptians, of course, pursued them. They didn't want them to leave. Not until they had sifted those whom they wanted to retain and those whom they wanted to drive out. They pursued them, but unsuccessfully. The Bible says that they were drowned in the Sea of Reeds in the Red Sea. But the modern Africans, the modern natives of South Africa, will remain in South Africa. They have no other place to go. And they are living within their ancestral home. It is the Afrikaners and the other Europeans who are the aliens and invaders. But these natives have now, after long centuries of dumb submissiveness, they have now come to feel that somehow They have been eating the bread of affliction too long. That they have endured too long unremitting and unrequited labor under hard and inhuman taskmasters. All about them, things are stirring in South Africa. A new life, the dawning of a new hope, independent and sovereign governments of African Negroes are springing up. Seven have come up within the last 2 years since the Second World War. The colored races of the entire earth are pressing forward towards freedom and equality. And they have begun to ask themselves, these dumb, submissive, exploited laborers, farmers, farm workers of South Africa, they've begun to ask themselves, how long will this minority of exploiting Afrikaners who disdain us, how long will they keep us in subjection and consign us to squalor and misery and indignities? And the answer to this question must come, but it must come soon. And who will give the answer? Will it be the native African? Will he give the answer through revolution and riots and bloodshed and strikes? All the 10 plagues of ancient Egypt? There are governments ready to put weapons in the hands of these people. Our government's ready to give them leadership. Will the white men in South Africa wait until the natives give the answer? Or will the answer come from the humane and moderate elements among the white people in South Africa, of whom there are many, who will unite to unseat this ruling nationalist party and put an end to this racial madness which is driving South Africa to the brink of disaster? The famous writer Alan Paton, whom you know from his great book Cried the Beloved Country, recently wrote in an article, he knows Africa and he loves Africa. And he speaks as a white man living in Africa. What is the hope? There is one hope and one hope only, he writes, for the future of the white people of South Africa, and especially for the Afrikaner. And that is to come to some kind of terms with the other 13 million. To negotiate, to discuss, to increase, not to decrease representation, to open the door, to unload the guns, to stop these stupidities, like not shaking hands with the native, to renounce the evil laws that result in violence and death, to forswear apartheid. Where Nazi racialism failed, Afrikaner racialism cannot succeed. It is too late in the day. The Afrikaner must abandon their ideologies. These ideologies are wicked fantasies spun out of selfishness and fear and false pride and lust for power. They must stop thinking in racial terms altogether. That's what the people of our southern states must come to do sooner or later. They must stop thinking in racial terms altogether. They must think in social and political and economic terms and just terms for all. These Afrikaners must realize that if they wish to remain in South Africa, that they must share a common destiny with the majority population on the basis of justice and freedom and humanity. It is not apartheid separation that they should be reaching for, but unity. Not the unity of conquest and domination, but the unity of brotherhood and cooperation and goodwill and give and take and share. In this age of ours, when man is making rockets to orbit through space, in this age of miraculous scientific progress and achievement, which is contracting our world and expanding contacts and relationships between men and nations, nothing else is possible. Where the human mind is carrying mankind forward triumphantly towards greater unity and solidarity and the identity of tasks and interests. How long can any single group of people, any racial group, how long can any nation, how long will it tolerate any such group because of greed and fear to stand in the way? Time is definitely here, this century, early part of the next century. The time is definitely near when men will have to learn the lesson which Passover taught a long time ago, that mankind is resolved to put an end to every form of bondage, and that the worst bondage possible in the world is when men choose to be masters. They are the slaves then. They are caught in the shackles of their own enslavement, fear and terror and brutality. Collectively they become less than human. Greatest bondage is when a man chooses to be master. The war for the freedom of mankind, political, social, economic, which began a long time ago in ancient Egypt, and which has continued with varying ups and downs through the ages, is reaching a climax in this or the next generation. It has been, up to now, an eternal struggle. The great Lincoln, who dealt with this problem, who faced all the problems of slavery and of slaveholders and emancipation, and who was martyred because of his effort to solve the problem, the great Lincoln, in his debate with Douglas, spoke of this thing. And I should like to put it in the hands of every Afrikaner, because here is a man who spoke from intimate knowledge of the same problem. "This is the real issue," declared Abraham Lincoln. "That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will ever continue to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other, the divine right of kings. It is the same principle in whatever shape it develops itself. It is the same spirit that says, you work and toil and earn bread, and I'll eat it. No matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race, it is the same tyrannical principle. What South Africa needs is another Abraham Lincoln. What South Africa needs is another Moses. Not to lead the native Africans out of Africa, but to lead them to freedom in their own land. They need a new Moses to lead the white men to an acceptance of Africa, to a ready adjustment to conditions which are inevitably there and which will prevail for all time to come. A Moses who will teach them to come to terms with living together in the same world, and not to insist on what they can no longer have or can have only for a very short time, because the time is very short, not to insist upon monopoly, upon domination, and upon exploitation. This, dear friends, is the eternal lesson of this profound and beautiful festival which we are celebrating, the festival of Passover.